This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on November the 3rd, 2000. Our speaker is Jeff M. of Campbell, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jeff and I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome you all to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bruce and Bob, you're in the right place. You know, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous out of a moment of desperation. And I've been struck clean and sober since then. But I'm getting way ahead of myself. You know, I grew up on the East Coast, some of you can probably detect already. I do have an accent. I'm from Southern Maine, and they do things a little different back there than they do out here. What it was like is I found drugs and alcohol at a very early age. They filled that big hole. They filled that big void, and it worked for a while. It worked for quite a few years, and then eventually, after abusing substances long enough, it didn't work anymore. When it didn't work anymore, I had to find another solution. You know, I couldn't fill the hole. I couldn't take care of the pain. I couldn't especially stop the voices. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 48 years old. I was born in 1952 in Rochester, New Hampshire. I probably took my first drink sometime in grade school, but I don't remember exactly when. I have vivid memories of stealing a Pabst Blue Ribbon out of my father's refrigerator and taking it out to the hedges, taking it out to the woods and drinking this thing and going down my neck and the front of me and stuff and going in the house and smelling like a beer and getting reprimanded for that. You know, I couldn't understand how the people knew that I was drinking, but they could smell it. My parents didn't drink at all. I saw my mother take maybe one or two cocktails a year, maybe at a wedding or a convention or something like that. I never, ever saw my father take a drink. That's another story. I bought my first alcohol. I have vivid memories of buying my first alcohol when I graduated from the sixth grade. We had a graduation party, and Harry Osgood and I split a pint of Myers Bay rum with Coca-Cola. And we just tore it up, you know, rum and Coke. And we went to the graduation barbecue and the little Wreck-It Hop, and we got irate. We got reprimanded for it. I had a brand new pair of my summer issue sneakers. I had a pair of canvas Converse high tops, and I tore them up. I ripped the side out of them, and those are my summer sneakers, so I had to wear torn sneakers for the rest of that summer, you know. And that was a sign right there that there's things to happen for me, and it just progressed from there, you know. I was also arrested for the first time in grade school, but I don't remember when. Sometime around the third or fourth grade, right in there. I was just so young, I don't remember exactly. But like any good con, you know, I was innocent. I didn't do it. Juvenile delinquents, you know. I got into high school. You know, I have a brother who's 7 years older than I am. In 1964, he graduated from high school and went to college, and his thesis, his theme paper on graduation was on LSD. It was 1966, and it just fueled my excitement. Just put a spark in me, you know. And the next year, 1967, I was in San Francisco. And came back that fall and just did whatever it took to get through the day. Just in full flight from reality already. I found crank, I found methamphetamine, I found blotter acid, I found alcohol. I found pot and hash and opium, the whole thing. And this was before I got out of high school. I was a mess. I was an absolute mess. I couldn't cope with reality. I had a lot of weird shit going on at the house and just couldn't cope with it. And the drugs and alcohol took care of that. You know, I could go to a high school dance and not feel right. But get a little libation in the parking lot and just go in there and dance until they turn the lights off. You know, that's the way it was. It just took me something. I could never do anything on the natch. I had to have something. I always had to have something to take the edge off. And being good country boys, we didn't always buy the store-bought alcohol. There was White Lightning. There was Homebrew. One of the first things I drank was hooch. Was homemade raisin wine. You know, we had farmers in the country that had big working farms, cornfields, hay fields. They raised cattle and potatoes, all that things. And when it came time to get the hay in, we'd go and help them. And for a reward for doing that, we got as much hard cider as we could drink. And normally it was just fermented apple cider, and it was hard cider. It would get you good and ripped. But as you got older and you could handle your liquor, and the farmers, you know, you knew that you were good for it. In the wintertime, they would take this hard cider out in the wooden barrels, and they would freeze it. And what didn't freeze was apple jack. And they would drain that off, and it's almost pure alcohol, and that would definitely light you up. And it was neat. It was neat. That was like real special occasions. It was insane. I got into growing pot when I was real young. That's another story. You know, by the time I was my sophomore junior year in high school that summer, I got a job in the cemetery. It's the only thing I could find for income, that legal income that summer. And I learned how to drive a truck and use heavy equipment and set explosives. And I went back to school that fall, and I let it known that what I had learned. You can never guess what I did this summer, you know, to my associates. And the word got out that I had the keys to the tool shack still with all the dynamite and stuff in there, and I stole a box of dynamite and blasting caps to trade for drugs. This was 1968, and a lot of different political things going on in the country then. There was revolutions in Mexico, and the IRA, the Irish thing was going on really big. And growing up in the East Coast and 45 minutes from Boston, it had a big influence on us in the underworld, the crime. I mean, that's where it all led you. If you wanted better things, if you wanted better quality things, you just had to, like, it's like peeling of the onion. You had to, like, you know, do your research, get out and find out, like, this connection and that connection and what that connection, where it came from, and get back to the point where, like, it came right off the ships. And some of the ships would take firearms and explosives back to Europe, back to Ireland, or down to Mexico and sell it. And that's what was going on. It was a whole loop. 1965, 1966, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, was about 20 miles from where I grew up. They were offloading bales of marijuana in broad daylight. And the locals thought it was seagrass. They just thought it was hay. I mean, it was that naive. It was still really, really naive then, you know. And I lived through that stuff, you know. I'm just a miracle that I stand here. I'm not bulletproof, you know. I just survived that stuff, you know. I graduated from high school in 1970. My draft number was 148. I had a 55% chance of going to Vietnam, and I got married instead. And 11 months later, I was divorced. Sometimes I still wish I'd gone to Vietnam, but not really. And that just led me into bigger and better things. In 1972, I was awakened by this loud, loud pounding on my door, and I got up and looked out the window, and there were four police cars in the driveway. I had a second-story apartment, and canine squad, and shotguns, and microphones, and spotlights, and all this stuff, and they were arresting me. And they came in and they arrested me and they searched my house, and I was growing pot in my attic. I was growing seedlings in my attic for cultivation. And they took me downtown and read me my rights and booked me and fingerprinted me and the mugshot, the whole nine yards, and I bailed myself out and went to court about 3 months later, and I hadn't had a haircut in over 3 years. And my head was shaven, and I had a brand new pair of blue jeans on and a denim shirt. And because I knew I was going down, I was going away. And through a series of circumstances and a damn good attorney, I got out of that. And what it was is they had no search warrant. And it could have gotten really, really ugly, but it got turned around, and I skated. You know, I just skated on that. 1972 to probably about 1976, 1977, I really don't remember much. My disease really, really escalated. I was a blackout drinker, a maintenance drinker, doing whatever it took to get through the day, holding various jobs. I can inventory up to a specific period of time. I can inventory up to about 1973, or I can inventory back to about 1977, 1976, but there's 2 or 3 years that are just a blackout. Just a blackout. And I survived, you know. I moved out here in 1979, and I transferred my union card out here from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I did a formal apprenticeship at a nuclear power plant in Seabrook, New Hampshire. And there were more men on that job than there were in my hometown. There were about 4,000 in the working force in 3 shifts. And that, for me, coming from the country, that was pretty amazing to see that kind of force and that kind of machinery and equipment in use on a daily basis. I came out here, and it was really, really good. I love the weather. I love the pay scale. I like the South Bay. Went up to San Francisco and revisited the places I saw in 1967. Everything was going fine for a while, you know, and then my drinking really, really got out of hand. I just couldn't get comfortable anymore, you know. It quit working. I could get to a point where I was feeling okay, I had a good buzz on, or I was completely blacked out, and there was no way to predict when that was going to happen. There was no way to predict, you know, my behavior or what was going to happen to me. And 1979, I came out of a blackout. I had an apartment over here on off of Blossom Hill, and I came out of a blackout to this really, really weird sound, like a shh, shh, going on. And what it was is my neighbor had me in a headlock, and he was flattening my nose. He was beating my nose shut, and that's the kind of drinking I was doing then. You know, I just I don't know why the guy was doing it. I must have pissed him off or something or whatever. But the guy was definitely breaking my nose, and that's something that hasn't happened to me clean and sober. You know, I haven't had the handcuffs on, I haven't had the elevator ride, I haven't had my nose broke, and it's a good deal. It's a good deal. It's a good thing. You know, 1981, a lot of stuff happened. The gal I'd been with for 3.5 years left. Finally, just couldn't put up with me anymore. And God bless her, it took me a long, long time. I made numerous, numerous amends to her, because when I got sober, I had to look at my responsibility in that relationship. And it took me a long, long time to feel right about that, and longer time for me to forgive myself for the things I did to her. Unbeknownst to me, she had been going to Al-Anon for a couple of years and trying her damnedest to put up with my alcoholism. And she had just had enough. And she moved out in August, and I had my nose broke the last time in September, and my dad died in November, just before Christmas. October, I had a construction foreman call me up after work, like on a Wednesday, Thursday night, and it was only 5 o'clock, and he asked me to go downtown for dinner with him, and I told him I couldn't go. And he goes, "What's the matter?" And I said, "I'm too drunk to go." He said, "Christ, you've only been home 45 minutes." I said, "I know, but I'm too drunk to go. I can't leave the house. I was that kind of hammered." You know, there was always the Coke tray and the little cigar box full of herb, and you know, the 151 on the refrigerator door, and that's the way that it was. And I come home from work, I would smoke on the way home from work, and I would get home and take my boots off, and that was it. I just lay back and just black out, you know. And that's when my drinking was taking me. But the fall of 1981, This same construction foreman turned me on to a program, this awareness thing. And one of the things that I went for the guest event, introduction to this program, and one of the things was that you couldn't use drugs and alcohol while you're in this training. And I said, "How long is the training?" And they said, 10 days. And I went, "Psh, I can do that for 10 days, you know, and I'll be cured," kind of thing, you know. I didn't have a clue, absolutely clueless of the disease of alcoholism, absolutely clueless as far as like... of anything. So I signed up. I signed up for this program, and I took it for about 10 days, and I had about, I think I had about 21 days of clean and sober in October 1981. It was the very first time in my life I was sober by choice. And it felt pretty good, and I was feeling good about myself, and it was even needed to wake up in the morning with money in your pocket, you know, and know where you've been, and that kind of stuff. You know, I had many peers in my life, men, uncles, associates, brothers, that were all, you know, all suffered, all from the same disease. But like I always told myself, well, I'm not that bad. If I get that bad, I'll stop. You know, and I've got to go back to the East Coast clean and sober and talk to some of these people, you know. And I was worse than they were, but I was just in denial. Just way, way, way in denial, you know. In the late 1970s, I ran with a bunch of motorcyclists from my home group back there, my home club back there. That there was 9 guys that started this club, and 7 of them are dead. You know, there by the grace of God go I. The man that I used to sit next to every day and commute to the nuclear power plant was beaten to death, and it was physically beaten to death, and it was all over a cocaine deal that went wrong. You know, it's just there by the grace of God go I. I've been shot at, you know, and there by the grace of God go I. I'm standing here, you know. But the fall of 1981 was like a real, real big emotional bottom. Kathy left, and my dad passed away, and I just left like a thousand unanswered questions between my dad and I. And I flew back and buried him, and there was like, I was just numb. I wasn't high, I wasn't blacked out, but I was like numb. And I took care of business, and I stayed there and had turkey with my mom, and flew back to California a few days later. And my dad's surviving brother called and asked me what I was going to be doing. You know, what's going on? What's going on in your life? And I shared with him at never forget this, at Point Reyes here in Northern California for the day, telling him what I've been up to. You know, what I've been doing, what I've been up to, and what was going on. And he told me that when I got back to Campbell, why don't I go to a couple of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I remember getting home about 2 a.m. and drinking until about 4, and just not catching the buzz. It just wasn't working for me. And about 9:30, 10 o'clock, I called the central office, and they asked me if I'd been drinking, and I told them yes, I had. And they said, they suggested I don't drink anymore, and that they were going to have somebody call me. And within a half hour, 20 minutes, somebody called me and directed me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was, for me, it's been that easy. I mean, it's been a lot of pain. Many, many times I've just wanted to get comfortably numb, and I haven't been able to do that. But we had the 12 steps and a loving God today, and one foot in front of the other, and it works. I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a Grapevine speakers group. And it was December the 11th, 1981. And they had it was on a Friday night, and the meeting started at 8:30. And at 7:30, they had a beginner's meeting that lasted about a half hour. And what it was is if you were new and you had any questions, they invited you to write the question on a small piece of paper and drop it in the coffee can. And they had a secretary and a chairperson up here, and they would draw questions out of the coffee can and answer them. That way there were no embarrassing questions. It was anonymous. And I sat through that meeting, and they gave me a proverbial half cup of coffee. I was shaking so bad. And it was okay. It was in a church. It was kind of spooky being there. I thought it was going to be like a Hare Krishna kind of thing or whatever, but, you know, that didn't happen. I didn't know at the time, but that same evening, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I met my sponsor. And so I stayed for the 7:30 meeting, and I stayed for the 8:30 meeting. The 8:30 meeting started, and they read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous how it works, and they read the steps. And it was like, what an order, I can't go through with it. You know, and it was explained to me right after the meeting that it was only one step at a time, it was only one moment at a time. I was so impressed when the meeting was over, I came forward to the secretary and asked him for an application. I wanted to join. I did. I thought there was something to fill out. I just didn't know. what was going on for me at home that night was I was living in a townhouse at Willow Glen with two other practicing addicts and alcoholics. And when I moved in there, the room that they rented to me, I just knew that I had arrived. I had to literally take a pair of lopping shears and cut the pot plants back to get my waterbed in. It had a beautiful southern exposure, and it had all these like incredible pot plants, and they showed me how to microwave this stuff and smoke it, and it was cool. But it just quit working. It just quit working. I moved out of there January the 19th, and it was really, really scary. They couldn't understand why I had to quit drinking. They couldn't understand why I'd gone straight, because they had to start looking at themselves, and it was real uncomfortable. And I had a friend in my past on the East Coast. Mickey used to hate Art Linkletter because Art Linkletter was so square. He was so straight. And that's what they were looking at with me. You know, it's like, no, he's a lop now. He's lame. He's not getting down with us, you know. We can't trust this guy no more, you know. And they took off to Lake Tahoe for the weekend, and I was about 5 weeks clean and sober, and it was real scary. I mean, I didn't know how much longer I was going to last in that kind of environment, but I knew that sobriety was my salvation. I could not possibly continue at the pace that I was going at. And I also forgot to add that at that time, and I had quite an extensive gun collection, and they had one of my handguns, and they went up to Lake Tahoe gambling for the weekend. And they came back, and I'd moved out, and they were really pissed off about that because they thought like I was going to roll over on them or something. And, you know, two really, really pissed off addict alcoholics with your handgun riding around town looking for you is not a good thing. And I got here with a lot of paranoia. And I had a lot of paranoia from stuff I'd done on the East Coast, too. So I got a room. I started renting rooms in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's been a trip. That was a real trip. I probably lived, my first 2 years of sobriety, I know I lived in at least 8 different places. You know, rent a room here until they can't put up with your attitude, or you're on the wrong step, or you don't smell right, or walk this walk, or go to the right meetings, and you're asked to move, and you find another place to live, or whatever, you know. It's just been a trip. I always told everybody the day I turned 30, I was going to stay in bed, and I was going to draw the blinds, just give it up, you know. The day I turned 30, I was flat on my back at Los Gatos Community Hospital. I had my first surgery clean and sober. As a result of the lack of nutrition, you know, the lack of any kind of palatable diet health-wise, I was driving myself to the hospital early on in sobriety once a week or so for just incredible abdominal pain. And I was real skinny. I weighed about 150 pounds, maybe 145 pounds. And they treated me for cirrhosis, for ulcers, for all kinds of stuff, and they just couldn't find out what was wrong with me. And they did an upper GI series and a lower GI series, and I'm just getting sicker and sicker by the day. I couldn't even keep down Maalox at the end of it. And what it was is I had gallbladder attacks. And the day I turned 30, the day after my gallbladder surgery at Los Gatos Community Hospital, and by then I had a sponsor. And there was another lady in the program that had probably 20 years in the program, and she was having a neck fusion. She was having a vertebrae work done. And I got to meet her husband because my sponsor knew her husband. And whenever they had an overflow of alcoholics in their visiting them, they'd come and visit me because I knew my sponsor was in my room, and it was just a networking thing. I got a lot of phone numbers. I got a lot of support. I got a lot of phone calls as a result of that. You know, I reached out and asked for help. I couldn't drive for a little while. And it was really cool. I had never been treated like that before. The only time I'd been treated like that, if you were holding, you had a large stash or whatever, you know, people like, you know, your fair weather friends kind of thing. But these people were earnest. And that's what it's like in Alcoholics Anonymous, is true friendship. Things progressed, you know. A lot of stuff happened my first year clean and sober. I had to work the steps. I did an inventory, shared it with my sponsor. Got into the steps. You know, did 4 and 5, 6 and 7. Had to do some amends work on the East Coast. Had to do some amends work here. I went home the very first time clean and sober in December 1982. I had just turned a year, and I went back for Christmas. My mom was still alive, and I went back for Christmas, and I flew into Boston and got a rental car and drove to Maine, and my hometown is on the border of New Hampshire and Maine. You drive across this little bridge across the Salmon Falls River, and I just got this overwhelming sense that it was going to be okay. I was scared. I had a list, and there were things that I wanted to accomplish while I was there. I had a year of sobriety. I had a lot of meetings under my back, under my belt. But I just had this overwhelming sense that as long as I kept my focus clean, everything was going to be all right. And I did it. Just like this incredible weight off my shoulders, just being back there in a clean and sober state. Really, really screwed up that community. I mean, I trashed my hometown. I trashed my parents, physically, mentally, spiritually, a lot, just caused a lot of discord. I went back to make amends to my in-laws, my ex-in-laws, mother and father-in-law and grandmother. Called my ex-wife, met with her, and told her what I was up to, and told her that I really wanted to see her mom and dad. I really wanted to see him. I wanted to apologize for him. I wanted to take responsibility for what I had done. And she said, no, that's okay. You don't have to do that. And I said, no, you don't understand. I really want to do this. I need to do this. You know, I want to clean up my side of the street. I want to take responsibility for what's going on. She goes, no, you don't understand. They never want to see you again. It's like, okay, that's the way it is. You have to be willing to make amends. God will put some specific people in your path, and you'll be able to do this. And it'll take care of itself. It'll definitely take care of itself. One of the toughest amends, one of the amends that I wanted to free myself of guilt. I wanted to apologize to the community. I wanted to apologize to the individual I'd ripped off. When I was a junior in high school, I took that dynamite. Didn't know how I was going to do that one. And it's now 1984. It's October, and my mom's passed away. I've been back there probably six times in 3 years for different surgeries and stuff and holidays, and my mom passed away. They got me out of school, and I flew back there, and I was home about 4 or 5 days when she finally passed on, and I got to do the flowers and pick out the casket and do the whole arrangements, and it was tough. It was really, really tough. But they have Alcoholics Anonymous back there. We have telephones out here. I kept in touch with the community, and we got through it. And buried my mom the next day, taking care of business, cutting him a check for the balance due. And I suddenly realized that this was the man that I ripped off when I was a junior in high school for the dynamite. And I cut him the check, and we were talking about this and that, and I changed the subject, and I said, you know, Mr. Lang, I want you to know that I was terribly wrong for what I did. Anything I can possibly do to make it right, tell me what's going on. You know, I was a punk kid. I was out of control. I had no excuses. This is what was going on. And he looked at me, and he pushed back in his chair, and he goes, that's right. That was you little bastard, wasn't it? Would you like another cup of coffee? And that was it. That was it. I mean, it's like tons and tons of weight came off my shoulder, you know. I was 4 years clean and sober at the time, getting haircuts and dental checkups on a regular basis, you know, holding a job, paying my own rent, that kind of things. And he'd seen the improvement. He saw that there was a change in me, you know, physical change in me. Pardon me. 1983, I was working a construction site in San Jose. And the guys at the hall, the guys at the union hall, definitely seen a change in me. And I didn't have any problem picking up work. And I'd met this guy 3 years prior to that, and we'd done a few jobs out of the hall together. And his name was Ron, and Ron and I decided that day to pick up a job out of the hall that's going to last about 3 or 4 months, and we took it. We found the job site and did the little interview that happens and stuff on the job site and hit it, you know. And we climbed up on the scaffolding and we was just doing it what we're supposed to be doing. You know, I'm clean and sober, he's clean and sober, and we're just giving it hell. And we stop for break and go back up, and it's about 1:30 in the afternoon, and Ron's getting really, really nervous. We're about three stories off the ground. Ron's getting real nervous, and I said, I turned to Ron. I said, Ron, what's the matter? Where's your faith, man? Don't you trust? Where's your faith in God? And as soon as I said the G word, the scaffolding collapsed out from underneath us, and I came down three stories. I chipped both elbows, grabbing studs coming down the way in, hitting plate lines, and my arms coming back out. And I landed on my feet like a cat, and I compressed the vertebrae and herniated two discs. And I had to have it fused. And but I landed on my feet and did all that, and rolled over onto my, fell on my back, rolled over to my side, and my, just so spiritual, my immediate reaction was fight, kill this SOB that built this scaffolding, you know. And I go to push up. I got up about halfway up on one elbow, and the scaffold plank hit me across the head. And all the hand tools started raining down on me, pinned me. And when the scaffolding collapsed, it was like a seesaw effect. My end went down, and Ron's end went up. And when his end went up, he just stepped right through the studs into the third floor and turned around and was watching all this stuff. And I just remember looking up at him, and he's going, man, he's dead. He's dead. I know he's dead. You know, I'm bleeding, I'm twisting, I got limbs going in directions I'm not supposed to be going that way. And it was grim. It was really, really grim. They called the ambulance. They couldn't get the ambulance to me in the back of the construction site. They had to walk in everything, all the paramedics equipment to life support, walk me in on the backboards and oxygen and all that stuff. And they picked me up. I was on the ground, and I was all taped down on this backboard. And they picked me up and put me on their shoulders to carry me out to the ambulance. And I never got the sensation of coming to rest on their shoulders. I just, like, I'm out of this body kind of thing, looking down. And I'm on 10th and Julian, right off of 101 by San Jose Steel. And I can see the traffic. I can see the whole darn thing going on, you know. And they're carrying this guy into the ambulance, you know. And they get this guy in the ambulance, and the door slams shut, and I'm back in my body. And I'm talking to the guys, you know. And they're telling me that just to chill, it's going to be okay. We're all stabilized. We started this IV. We're giving you some oxygen. Don't fight it. It's going to be okay. We're taking to Alexium Brothers, and, you know, another chapter in my life. You know, I got into Alexian Brothers Hospital, and the doctors that performed the first surgery on me was the man that teaches that procedure for scoliosis, for curvature of the spine on kids. And he perfected this. He invented this thing, and that's how they repaired my back. They put in these stainless steel rods, and they took bone from my right hip and did the fusion and installed these stainless steel rods on each side of my spine. And cast me to a fiberglass cast, and I walked around on that for over a year. And I'll tell you, it's like, that's when my program, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous really kicked in. Because I couldn't do anything. All I could do is lay in bed. And I was in the hospital for 28 days, and there was first few days, I didn't know if I'd ever walk again. And got all those sensations back, and a tremendous amount of therapy, and some more surgeries, and I've come through it. You know, I was 33 years old. I went in the hospital at 6'1½", and I came out at 6'2". They fused my back, they took a small curve out of it, so I actually grew a half inch, and got to meet just a tremendous amount of people. I turned two. In 1983, I turned two in Alexian Brothers Hospital, and they had a singing, stripping telegram for me, and birthday cakes and balloons, and I'm just, it's like, I don't know what's going on. That was, the initial onset was the 10th, and I turned two on the 12th. No, the initial onset was the 3rd, and I turned two on the 12th, so it was 9 days after seven and a half days after the surgery. And I'm still all wired for sound. I don't know which end is up still. And they had Saturday Night Live people, you know, had this big, numerous birthday parties for me throughout the day. They started at 10 o'clock in the morning, and it was like the cakes just kept coming in, you know. Two or three cakes, and the sun went down, and the stripping telegram came in, and it was really, really cool, you know. And I got up the next morning, and just really, really depressed. I didn't want to be there. I just had this... I had a head full of AA and a belly full of drugs, and there was nothing I could do about the drugs. And it was just, you know, the voices were starting to come back. You're useless. You're a piece of whatever, you know, just the paranoia. The phenomenon of craving was there. I just wanted to die. I really didn't want to die. And I'm terribly, terribly nearsighted. My fingers actually disappear at arm's length if I don't have some kind of correction, and I've got contacts in right now. And I woke up the morning after the celebration, and I turned my head this way, and all I could see was like orange. And I turned my head straight ahead, and I saw yellow. And I turned my head to the left, and all I could see was blue. So it was like red, blue, and orange, and that's all I could. And I knew I was losing it. You know, I always questioned my sanity. One of my biggest fears was to die in an asylum, you know, in a straitjacket and 5-point restraints or something, you know. And I knew I'd flip my lid. This was it. I mean, the birthday party was too much, and I'd gone over the edge. There's no rewinds. And what it was is they had helium-filled balloons tied to my headboard had deflated, and they're now down around my face, and I'm looking. I'm focusing through these balloons, you know, just totally freaked out. Just totally freaked out. So sobriety's a kick. Sobriety's a hoot, you know. 1985, stuff's going on at work, and it ain't happening. I'm trying to get back to work. I'm 2 years after this stuff, and you know, I'm going to school and I'm going to rehab and I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm not happy. I'm not doing what I want to do. I wanted to stay in construction. Construction's out of the question, so I get into construction estimating, and that was really, really good for me, you know. And I did construction estimating for about 7 years, and I got to see a lot of the Bay Area down to Monterey and up into Marin County, all of San Francisco, the peninsula, out to Concord. I got to meet a lot of different people at noontime meetings all throughout Northern California. It's been a real trip. Sobriety for me, probably one of the toughest things for me in sobriety was like housing, was like you know, a sense of permanence, a sense of ownership. Just like, you know, this is like my nest kind of thing. It's just been always. For me, you know, my psyche, it's just always been important to me. And 1991, about the third time in sobriety, the landlord put the house up for sale. I had to move for the third time because of the sale thing going on, you know, and I was really, really tired of it. And I forgot to mention, too, this is something really, really important. I forgot to mention that when I got here, I didn't have a credit card or a checking account, none of that stuff. I had to learn all that stuff clean and sober. And my sponsor taught me how to do that. Taught me how to deposit checks and not cash them. Taught me how to write checks and balance a checking account. Taught me how to make out a credit card application and not lie about it. And to hold a job long enough to have a reference on a credit card application. That was a bitch, too. So we did all that one. So 1991 comes around, and I just didn't want to do this one anymore. And I've been saving money, and I'd come into some money, and I met a guy downtown that I used to sponsor, and he was in real estate, and I was telling him what's going on. He goes, "Let's go out for lunch." So he took me out to lunch, and we made out a pre-approved credit application for a piece of property. And he showed me how to look it up on a website, a real estate site, and I bought my condominium in Campbell, you know. And living the lifestyle that I lived and coming from where I'm coming from, those things just don't happen. It just didn't happen. And I thought it was going to be the American dream. I mean, for this boy, it was. I mean, it was like, you know, having my own place, this little condominium, it's like a little bat cave kind of thing, you know. I just, electric garage door open, and just drive the truck in and shut it, and drive the truck out and shut it, you know. It's just really, really cool. It hasn't always been that way. Making the mortgage, sometimes you just don't know where the money's going to come from. And then if you don't plan for it, you don't know where the tax money's going to come from. And you have the thing called neighbors that you have to contend with. And it's like, it's been exciting. It's been very, very exciting. They definitely know they got an alcoholic on their hands at 866 Apricot Avenue in Campbell, California. You know, but I don't know. It's embarrassing, but I'll tell you right up front, man. I've had the police over my house a couple times, clean and sober, because of my temper. You know, I just take it and take it and take it, and I just like, you know, I crank the stereo up and leave for 2 or 3 days, and I come home and the cops are waiting there for me. You know, it's like, hey, take a hint. You know, you make noise, I make noise. It's called retaliation. You know, but it's getting better. It's getting better. We opened up another line of communications here recently. And it's getting pretty cool. I don't know. It's like, you know, when I got here and I looked my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I read how it works and the steps, I knew that was my salvation, but I didn't know how I was going to do it. I had just like, there's no way that might work for you, but I couldn't possibly work all of those 12 steps and do those things and clear up the wreckage of my past. And I'm here to tell you, you can. If I can, you can, and countless others have too. You know, I did my first inventory, and I rode around with two different sponsors trying to dump that thing. And looking back now in hindsight, I had poor choice of sponsors. They had never done an inventory, so they couldn't, you know, go over my inventory with me. So I was stuck with this thing and two, you know, wannabe sponsors, and it didn't work. I finally was able to unload that at a sponsor's house. He had almost 25 years of sobriety when he listened to my inventory, you know. And when we were done, we burnt it in the kitchen sink, and it was onward and upward for better things. You know, the God thing has been a real trip. I think it's probably normal. It's natural for most of us to come in here pretty bankrupt spiritually, and the God thing was frightening. Was like real hokey. Was like no. I don't understand that stuff. I don't believe that stuff. I used to stand there at the end of the meeting and recite the Lord's Prayer with my sponsor, and he would ask me, "Do you believe?" And I'd say, "I don't know." He goes, "Do you believe that I believe?" And I'd say, "Yeah, you know, I believe that you believe." And he goes, "Do you believe that we believe, the group?" And I'm going, "Yeah, I can conceive that. I can believe that the group believes." He said, "That's all you got to do. You just believe that I believe and believe that the group believes." And then he gave me my first God, which was G-O-D, which was Group of Drunks. I didn't make the group my higher power, but it became a force. It became a power in my life that was greater than myself. And after, you know, sticking around here long enough and listening to people's stories and relating to everyone, you know, it started a foundation for me. I've never, ever heard anyone tell my story. But collectively, you've all told my story, little bits and pieces of it, you know. I heard a guy in Southern California that was real parallel, real, real close to what we did. The higher power thing, the search for an all-loving God, the search for a higher power in my life has brought me to a lot of different stuff. I tried to go back to the church of my childhood. My parents were very active in the Methodist church back in Berwick, Maine, and I went to a couple of Methodist church here in the valley, and it wasn't for me, you know. I've been to a lot of spiritual retreats, and that's helped a lot. I've tried different forms of meditation in order to allow myself to be centered and relaxed and be able to focus on something like that. I think the highest, without a doubt, that I've ever been, the most connected I've ever felt to a higher power was 2 years ago this coming Christmas. I went to an event at the Santa Clara Convention Center, and that it was Christmas Day, and they had around 8 different spiritual leaders from around the world. They had a Sioux medicine man. They had an Australian aboriginal. They had a Tibetan monk. They had Catholic priests. They had a rabbi. They had a minister. I know I'm forgetting something. And they just came, and they performed their highest spiritual ceremony, an abbreviated portion of it. And I was just lifted. I mean, I was just rocketed to see that many different faiths, that many different denominations, and that many different walks of life and civilizations and cultures in one building, all striving for the same thing, and it was just a loving God, an all-powerful God. I've gotten into some stuff. I've gotten into some reading that I know that my parents would definitely not approve of. It's like way out of their comprehension. It's like, you know, Christ, this kid's been in California way too long. They've just taken him over, you know. And but this is where the stuff has led me. I've gone to an ashram in Berkeley a few times, and that's really worked for me. I just found out this week, listening to KFOG out of the city, that the Dalai Lama is coming to the Bay Area next year in in May, and I'm definitely going to be there. I want to, you know, I'm not going to have a private audience with the guy, but I want to go. I want to go see. I just want to be in his presence, and I want to go see what he has to offer. And that's just the beauty. That's just one of the things. One of the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous is that has allowed me to open up enough to go and to you know, want to participate in those avenues. And I, you know, and this is like, you know, I said this a couple of weeks ago at a meeting in Los Gatos, and the next person got up and, you know, just like shot up full of hoes, like it's so corny, it's so hokey. But it's like, you know, for me today, it's like, you know, it's just a little quote from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's, you know, for a bottle and a hangover, I've been given the keys to the kingdom. You know, for a guy that, you know, didn't really know, well, I knew how to get my next tank of gas, I knew how to get my next fix, but it wasn't real pretty. And as a result of coming here and working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and staying in the solution and stuff, I know where it's coming from. All I have to do is suit up, show up, and it takes care of itself. You know, I've been able to, you know, maintain this mortgage payment for like 9 years, and I'm just sitting in Fat City right now, real estate wise. I just can't believe the gift that's happened to me as a result of that. You know, I'm 48 years old, and I'm thinking. You know, I'm not, it's like a fantasy kind of thing, but I'm thinking about retirement. I mean, I'm not going to retire tomorrow. I'm not going to retire in 10 years. But at least today I can entertain that idea. And coming from where I came from, you know, I got here when I was 29 years old, and I didn't think I was going to make 30. You know? And then getting into my 30s and my health going away and, you know, getting into having all these surgeries and stuff, I didn't think I was going to see 40. You know? And it's just a cool thing to do. It's just a cool place to be. I've become teachable today. You know, I've become a better student today. I'm trying to think. Probably the only campus I haven't attended in the South Bay is Evergreen College. You know, I've been able to do that one. I've been able to go back. I don't have a degree, but I've become a student. I've become teachable. I've gone back and I've taken specific courses addressing specific things as I've needed them in a work situation, you know. Hopefully right after Thanksgiving, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, I'll go to L.A. for a couple of days for a class down there on coordinate measuring machines. I'm a precision mechanical inspector now, you know. It's a great place to be. I'm finally making the money in the year 2000 that I was making in 1983 when I fell and broke my back. I've got union, pretty much my union wages back and benefits and stuff. And it's just, there are a lot of times I'm a real capitalist, guys. I'm a real capitalist. I love money. You know, I love the fat paycheck and stuff. And it's good, bad, or indifferent. You know, it's been a real struggle. You know, I've been through the recessions and stuff. I've been unemployed. I've been employed. I had, when I qualified for my condominium, I was working 3 jobs. And I had to sign an affidavit saying that, yeah, this is the truth, and I am doing this, and this is what my income is. And within 3 months of getting my mortgage, I lost all my income. All those jobs went away. And it was real, real, real scary, you know. And so I went to school for 6 months full time and became something else. I don't know what the hell's going on. I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. I don't know what I'm going to be doing 6 months from now. I had a pretty good idea I might be doing the same thing. You know, but there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee. This year, in the year 2000... January the 13th, the year 2000, I was driving to work on San Tomas Expressway, and I was stopped at a red light in my pickup and drinking a cup of coffee. I had a brand new insulated Christmas mug, and I had my foot on the brake, and they had 5 cars stopped in front of me, and I was in the middle lane. This guy came off the freeway and hit me doing 45 miles an hour in my pickup truck. My seat back broke and went down. And I slid up out of my seatbelt, and my head went through the windshield in the back of the cab. And I cut up my nose pretty good with the coffee cup, burnt myself with the hot coffee. And all I can do is sit there in the truck, and it's about 5:20 a.m., sun's not up yet, and all I'm thinking of is flashing on is falling off the scaffolding again. You know, when my head hit the window, it's like shotgun going off between my ears. I mean, it just boom. And I was absolutely terrified. I was not going to get out of that truck. and I was waiting for the next car to hit me, like a chain reaction kind of thing. I was just waiting for the next car to hit me. And the light turned green 2 or 3 times, people just going through it, you know. Finally CHP shows up. They come over and I hit the switch on the door and the window goes down, and I'm sitting there and I'm crying hysterically. And the guy's going, "What's the matter?" It's like, and I just tell this guy, "You don't understand. You don't understand, you know." So I told him my story, where I was at, and he said, "You know what? You did the right thing. And just try to regain your composure. Stop crying. Everything's going to be cool. We'll take care of you." And I said, "No, you don't understand. It's my back. It's my back. It's my back." And they took me out of there on the backboard, you know, and they finally got me out of the truck, and they taped me down to another backboard. They put me on a gurney. And I remember looking up, and the sun coming up over the east foothills, and the seagulls flocking around, and I got my forehead taped down to this thing, and it's like, again, absolute powerlessness, you know, who's in charge kind of thing. And got to the hospital, and x-rayed me, and I got a whiplash and stuff, and they released me, and I called one of my very best friends that I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I call him, and he says, "No problem, I'll stop what he's doing right now," and he comes and gets me. And it's like, you know, that's like the relationships that you form around here. I mean, just unconditional, priceless relationships. That's in January this year. April of this year, I turned 48, and I'm up doing one of the favorite things I started to do, clean and sober. I'm still having a little difficulty with it, but one of the hobbies I've acquired clean and sober is abalone diving, is snorkeling, free diving, you know. And we went up, the group, there was a few of us here from this group, we went up, and we came home from that on a Sunday night, and I'm cleaning up, putting away my camping gear, and folding the stuff, and doing laundry, and I'm making tuna fish salad for tomorrow. I'm like real lame, just real lop. I'm making tuna fish salad for tomorrow, sandwiches for lunch, and just doing all this real, you know, normal shit. And I go to bed, and it's about 2:30 in the morning, and it's like I sit right straight up out of bed, and I can't figure out where this pain's coming from. And it's just like my gallbladder grew back or something, you know. And it's kidney stones this time, you know. So I have to go past kidney stones clean and sober this year, you know. This year's been real physical stuff, you know. After that, like, you know, I had, that was April, May, I had a root planing. And in July, I had root surgery. I had gum surgery, you know. And it's just like you just keep going on and on. August, I was fired, you know. 2 days later, I started the job I got today, you know. You just never know where it's going to come from, when it's going to happen. It's like, you know, they tell us around here, it's like clean house and trust in God. You know, clean house and trust in God. And if I have anything to offer any of you, that's the simplicity of it, you know. Work the steps to the best of your ability. Get a sponsor. Get a God of your understanding, an all-powerful, you know, unconditional loving God, and clean house and trust in others. You know, trust in God. What helped me early on in sobriety is I got some heroes. I got some men that I saw that were constant. They had this constant in their life. They had what I considered a normal life. They had a 9-to-5. They had a wife. They had a house. They had children. They were like normal, but they were alcoholic, because I heard their stories from the podium and I related to these guys. They were as crazy as I was. It's like instant asshole, just add alcohol, watch out. You know, and I made these guys my friends, and I buried most of them. I'm almost 20 years clean and sober, and these guys were old men when I got here. I guess I was looking for a father figure or something, you know. One of the guys that I just truly, truly admired, I met at the Alano Club, Alano West. And one day this guy came in and he was just absolutely enraged, just livid, you know. Goes to sit down, the chair wasn't right, gets up, kicks the chair over, and it's like totally out of character for this guy. But he's at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, he's telling somebody about what's going on, and he's giving it up. He's seeking solution and he's giving it up. And what had happened is his daughter had just pulled an armed robbery of a bank in downtown San Jose and gotten busted. You know, but at the guy... that's the guy was in the solution. That's where he was at. You know, I remember this other old cowboy, this other old hero I had, and his claim to fame is he had a 1506. And in his drinking career, what drunk drivings were 502s. They're no longer called 502s. They're called something else, and I don't remember what the term is. But they were 502s, and he had a 1506. He had three drunk drivings in 24 hours. You know, and I related to this guy, you know, because on a good day, on a good Saturday, I'd pass out at least twice. I'd get up in the morning and black out, pass out by like 1 or 2 in the afternoon, get up about 4 or 5 and do it again until the wheels fell off around midnight. And then it was the next day, it was Sunday. But I totally related to these men, you know. My sponsor dragged me around to a lot of meetings I did not want to go to, made me stick my hand out, made me do stuff I did not want to do in the name of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it worked. It worked. In the olden days, you know, we smoked at meetings and they had ashtrays and real coffee cups, and you washed ashtrays and you washed coffee cups at the Campbell Group, the Campbell meeting, 1200 West Campbell, which was used to be a huge meeting, at least 200 people. There was a lot of stuff to wash, there was a lot of stuff to clean after the meeting. And I met some of the people that are still sober today in my life in those kitchens doing stuff like that. My sponsor told me that when I had a year of sobriety and I could qualify, need a background check, that you will go back to jail. And I didn't want to do that one. The last place I want to do is go back to jail clean and sober, you know. And I did it. And I did it. I went to the Boys Ranch in Elmwood and downtown and different facilities and stuff, you know. Some of those facilities don't even exist anymore, you know. But it's all about giving it away in order to keep it, you know, being in service to others in order to keep it. I didn't think I was going to talk this long. I'm real glad to see that it's way after 9 o'clock. You know, thanks for putting up with me. I know some of you, like, I just bored to death. You've got nothing left. God bless you. I hope you find the message someplace else. You know, that's the beauty of living in the Bay Area here. There are so many meetings here, you know. So many meetings here. We had a friend that moved away that just come back and was telling us about living in Montana and attending Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and having to go to Idaho for an AA meeting from Montana. Now that's going to any length, you know. So God bless, and please keep coming back. Thank you very much.